This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. According to the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission, eastern North Carolina's black bear population has made a comeback. Today, the population sits at just over 10,000, compared to the paltry 2,000 three decades ago. Black bear biologist Colleen Olfenbuttle says the increase stems from both a planned effort on part of the Wildlife Resources Commission and favorable conditions in eastern North Carolina.
We created designated bear sanctuaries that allowed those bears to reproduce, those populations to grow, and then the surplus bears would leave the sanctuaries and repopulate the surrounding area.
In 1971, 28 bear sanctuaries were created, encompassing nearly 800,000 acres. Protecting these areas where breeding female bears reproduce has been instrumental in the recovery of the bear population in the state. Olfenbuttle says another contributing factor is the amount of farmland here.
There's just an abundance of food in eastern North Carolina, not only natural foods for the bears, but a lot of agricultural foods such as corn, soy, wheat.
Black bears are found mostly at the coast and in the mountain region of North Carolina. They are 6 feet in length, and adults can weigh upwards of 300 pounds. The current world record black bear from Craven County weighed in at 880 pounds. Now that the black bear populations have returned to a healthy level, the Wildlife Resources Commission is hoping to sustain that growth.
And we feel that we've successfully restored bears in eastern North Carolina from historic lows that occurred, especially in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And so now that we've restored the bear population, our management goal for that population is to stabilize it, basically try to have it where we have a sustainable harvest in eastern North Carolina and also a stable bear population.
In most cases, that means loosening regulations on bear hunting, which is considered to be the best way to control their populations. Despite outcry from animal advocates, policies for bear baiting, a hunting practice using food to lure bears, are changing. Wildlife Officer Sergeant William Kane says hunters can only use non-processed foods like peaches, apples, and meat scraps.
This season it'll be legal to bait bear by people still hunting, but it has to be done only the first week of the season, and it can only be anything that's not been processed, has been natural food product.
Kane says hunters still won't be able to bait bear in sanctuaries. Bear season in eastern North Carolina will remain the same this year, from November 10th to the 15th, and from December 15th to December 25th. Perhaps the biggest change for this year's bear hunting season is that hunters are now required to purchase a bear e-stamp.
Right now, we don't know how many people are actually hunting bear, because prior to this year, unless you were coming from out of state, you had to buy a special license to hunt bear. This year, everybody's going to have to buy the e-stamp.
Sergeant Kane says hunters can purchase a $10 bear e-stamp from the same place they buy their hunting license. They're also available online at ncwildlife.org. He says this season will be the first time bear hunting is allowed in the Piedmont region.
And the reason for that was the bear population was expanding into areas where normally bear didn't live. So now we're trying to manage those bears and keep them into their areas that are originally habitat.
The black bear hunting regulation changes were approved in February, and they took effect August 1st. A lighthouse that helped provide safe passage to river mariners for around 50 years now has safe harbor itself. The Roanoke River Lighthouse has been restored and is open to the public for tours this weekend. George Olson has more.
3 seems to have been the magic number for the Roanoke River Lighthouse. The first lighthouse was built in Plymouth in 1866. It was destroyed by fire in 1885. Its successor was destroyed after less than a year in service by ice, yep, not a hurricane, but ice, before the third and last Roanoke River Lighthouse was built in 1886. It was decommissioned in the 1930s, and it and 2 other lighthouses in the region were contracted to be removed from the river. The first 2 didn't make it back to dry land. The third did.
Mr. Wiggins, it took him quite a long time to, it took him a full like 36 hours to take it off of the pilings and then another 32 hours to move it to land in Edenton. And he said that it brought a lot of attention to the harbor when he was pulling in, basically, with this lighthouse on his barge, that probably if the President of the United States was drowning in Edenton Bay, it wouldn't have drawn so much attention as he was receiving. Those are kind of his words from his oral history of his connection to the lighthouse.
Karen Ipock, the site manager of the historic Edenton State Historic Site, talking about Emmett Wiggins, who, after a friend's failure with moving two other lighthouses, was successful in moving the Plymouth Lighthouse to a site just west of Edenton. For the most part, it was Emmett Wiggins' residence until he died in 1995. But though he modernized it to make it comfortable for everyday living, Emmett Wiggins was conscious of the lighthouse's history and acted as much as a preservationist as he did a homeowner.
Very true to what the building used to be and didn't want to take away those characteristics of it. So the floors in it, he just covered with carpet, but he kept the original floors, the window shutters, several things he just saved of the original lighthouse and preserved. And he even worked hard to get a fog horn for it and the bell, fog bell, and a Fresnel lens for it.
Which meant when the Edenton Historical Society was successful in purchasing the lighthouse more than a decade after Emmett Wiggins' death, while there was work to do to restore it, there was no starting from scratch. Time had taken some toll on the building, and after the first two Roanoke River lighthouses were destroyed by fire and ice, water nearly did the structure in the summer of 2003.
Unfortunately, it did have to sit for several years after his death, uninhabited, which took its toll, as you would imagine, on any building. And then Hurricane Isabel furthered the damage. It was right there at a creek on the land, kind of exposed to the elements, and the hurricane, when it came through, it did a lot of damage to the Edenton area and sadly took away some of the porches of the outside porch of the lighthouse.
It's been about 10 years since the lighthouse purchase. That time has been spent making the repairs that 100-plus years of history and a couple of moves will bring, as well as searching out and bringing to the lighthouse furnishings from its original 1886 period that are appropriate for lighthouse keepers' use at that time. Among the highlights of that search, one done by the lighthouse's last owner, Emmett Wiggins, is a Fourth Order Fresnel lens.
It was tracked down through the Coast Guard. By that point, the Coast Guard had taken over as the overseer for the lighthouse system. So they were willing to donate it basically to the town, and then the town in turn loaned it to Mr. Wiggins to have in the lighthouse. At his death, it was removed from the lighthouse for protection back to the town. It definitely needs some restoration, just being over 150 years old. So it's going to have some restoration done to it before it goes back into the lighthouse.
It's not the same lens that lit up the Roanoke in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, but of the same order. The lighthouse is ready for the public, but still work remains to be done. The restoration and then return of the Fresnel lens, plus Karen Ipock hopes they can locate items like a lighthouse keeper's uniform and the official U.S. Lighthouse Service china and blankets of that era.
We still have some things that we still are hunting for, I guess you can say. But when you go into the lighthouse, you'll see it well furnished. I think it's always an ongoing process when you have a historic house to keep it appropriate and to always update it, which sounds funny since it's updating it with historical items, but always keeping the collection as most accurate as you can.
Karen Ipock is site manager for the historic Edenton State Historic Site. Guided tours of the restored Roanoke River Lighthouse are underway this weekend. They'll be offered on a 7-day-a-week schedule for the foreseeable future. I'm George Olson.
The Downeast Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Kitchen on Trend. Open 6:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday, weekends till 2 p.m. Announcing an expanded cafe menu for dine-in or full meals to go, plus office, dinner, and cocktail catering. Kitchen on Trent. As summer draws to a close, you may be planning a couple more trips to the beach. So it's important that you know about a silent killer that lurks beneath the surface of the water. And we're not talking about sharks. Rip currents are powerful channels of water that form when a sandbar breaks. Moving at speeds of 8 feet per second, these dangerous currents suck their victims out to sea, claiming 100 lives each year in the United States. Knowing what to do if you find yourself in a rip current can save your life. This week, Lee Jenkins speaks with National Weather Service meteorologist Tom Lanka about rip current safety and research being done in coastal North Carolina to develop better models to forecast rip currents.
Now, you're a meteorologist, correct?
That's correct.
And what sort of work have you done with rip currents? I understand you're something of a rip current expert at the Newport facility.
Yes, what we do is we put out a forecast daily. We have a calculator that calculates rip current risk based off the wave period, wave height, and the tidal variation. And that outputs a value depending on all those variables.
I understand a branch of NOAA recently conducted some research regarding rip currents.
Yes, the National Ocean Service, locally here at the Newport office, we have a PhD from the National Ocean Service is working closely with us and the lifeguards along the Northern Outer Banks to develop a rip current model. What they use at NOS is a particular model in conjunction with the Nearshore Wave Prediction Center, which is a high-resolution wave model that we here at Newport run every day.
What sort of equipment are they using to make this new model?
They are buoys outfitted with GPS devices that track their paths through the currents, and data that's later downloaded and analyzed from these drifters. And the information will help the researchers and forecasters learn more about rip currents, potentially leading to more accurate risk assessments and improved safety measures.
Are there any sort of telltale visual cues that indicate where a rip current has formed?
Yes, there's a noticeable break in the pattern of the waves. The water often looks flat where the rip current is, in contrast to the line of breaking waves on either side of the rip current. Sometimes they can be looked at as kind of a river of foam. More importantly, the rip currents are much more identifiable if the viewer is elevated. Lifeguards have a very good vantage point of where these rip currents are. So beachgoers should definitely talk to a lifeguard if they're going to go into the water.
Can you view rip currents with satellite imaging?
Not so much satellite imagery because rip currents are very small, or I guess localized in nature.
Is there any way to reliably escape from a rip current?
Yes. If caught in a rip current, the swimmer is advised to don't fight it. Swimmers can easily exit the rip current by swimming just a few strokes parallel to the beach. The rip currents are usually very narrow, so they can be avoided or exited fairly easily.
Are rip currents a year-round occurrence, or do they form seasonally?
Year-round. They're especially most prevalent when there's an offshore tropical system due to the larger waves, the larger swell period. So even though it could be a beautiful day outside, there may be a tropical storm that are hundreds of miles, even 1,000 miles away from the coast and be causing indirect rip current related hazards on the shore.
Is there any advice you'd give to beachgoers for the rest of the season?
I would advise beachgoers to pay attention to the flags. Talk to a lifeguard before entering the water and just be very observant.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. There's many of you that I think probably believe that you're a gardening season is over for this year, and that those sad-looking plants in your garden are begging you to walk away until next spring. Others, well, you didn't get a garden in this year, and you're thinking, oh well, maybe next year. But right now is actually the beginning of the best time of year for vegetable gardening in coastal North Carolina. No, I'm not kidding. Fall gardening is absolutely spectacular here. You'll be planting vegetables that you harvest for Thanksgiving and Christmas dinner, and some, believe it or not, that you will be harvesting next February. If your garden is already prepared, if you have your space selected and your bed ready, and you simply need to clean up from the summer, well, go do it. Make sure you take out every bit of leaf litter and root, everything you can from the summer plants, because if they're like mine, right now they're eaten up with diseases and insects, and you just want them out of your garden. Once you've pulled up all the old vines, taken out the old leaves, and you have a fresh new slate to begin with, what should you be planting? Well, carrot seeds can already be in the ground, and starting any time now, you can plant your beet seeds. And kohlrabi, mustard greens, rutabagas, spinach, all sorts of things that you plant from seed can go in the ground right now. Soon, within about 2 weeks, it'll be a great time to start putting transplants in the ground. Yes, those plants that are going to go in as transplants. Think in terms of your cabbage and kale, collards and broccoli. A lot of people transplant those. Well, the greenhouses on the coast already have them growing, and they are beautiful. And depending on what the weather does within the next couple weeks, any time could be the best time to put them in the ground. Every year, well, it's a little experiment to figure out what's exactly right. And the best plant for the fall, one that can only be planted in the fall here, garlic. About September 15th through the end of October, depending on the year, is when you put garlic in the ground, and then you harvest it, well, sometime around mid-June. If you want to know exactly which plants to grow in the fall here on coastal North Carolina, go to my county extension website, carteret.ces.ncsu.edu. That stands for Cooperative Extension Service, North Carolina State University, and then EDU for education. Go to the Lawn and Garden page and scroll down to the Growing Food in Coastal Carolina, and you'll find the month-by-month calendar there. It will tell you what to plant in which month. One more thing. For those of you who thought you were about finished with beautiful fresh vegetables from local farms, that's not true either. Although we're in a bit of a lull right now between the midsummer plants and the first crops to harvest in late summer, there's still sweet corn getting ready to come off. And our farmers now plant sweet corn every few weeks, so there's likely to be fresh corn being picked for the next couple of months. Keep going to your farm stands or to your farmer's market and look for fresh vegetables. Maybe when you were a kid, they were only available for a few weeks, but some of your favorites are going to be available much longer. And then when the last of that late sweet corn is gone, well, they'll start harvesting spinach and lettuce and kale and collards and broccoli, the same things that I talked about earlier that you can plant in your own garden. So get out there, get ready for fall planting, and keep going out and seeing what your local farmers have available. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
The Siler City-based bluegrass quartet New Blue received national accolades with their third CD release, 10, last summer, achieving top 10 bluegrass sales status in an August edition of Billboard magazine. And they're touring now in advance of a September release of their next CD, All the Way, which will include guest appearances by notables including Rhonda Vincent and Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Sam Moore. Last year's 10 marked their 10th year as a performing unit, remarkable in that the band nearly dissolved as soon as it formed. George Olson spoke with the group's founder on the release of their debut CD back in 2010 and has this, which originally aired in August of that year.
The Siler City-based New Blue was initially formed in the fall of 2003, and that's where the story almost ended. On Thanksgiving weekend, shortly after the quartet came together, one of the band's two founders, Carolyn Ruth, suffered not one but two strokes that initially left her without speech and the use of her right side. With a push from then-bandmate and friend and now bandmate and husband Daniel Ruth, she made it all the way back.
Thank the Lord that her speech came back very quickly. But it became one of those things of, you know, before it was, we're going to do this because this is what we want to do when we're all musicians and things like that. And then it became an even greater need to continue on with New Blue, and
it was therapeutic, really.
It was. there was a lot of therapy involved, and music's good therapy anyway. So you know, if you can combine that with therapy that you have to do, it just works.
It was a common goal.
You can hear evidence of Carolyn Roos' complete recovery with the recent release of the band's first CD release, Nights. The disc is a nice mix of traditional and contemporary bluegrass sounds, leaning a bit toward the traditional, but fans of so-called newgrass artists like Alison Krauss will almost certainly find the disc to their liking. That could come from the Roos' eclectic background. Carolyn started singing in church, did musicals in high school, loves the music of Pat Benatar, sang contemporary Christian music, and performed rock before forming New Blue. Daniel is a banjo player turned rock band bassist in the same band as Carolyn, turned guitar player in New Blue, who says he's as likely to be listening to Van Halen as Flat and Scruggs.
Just about anything that we can come up with, we usually find a way to make it fit. Let's try to do this song. Let's bring this new song in from whatever genre and let's see how it works. And then we end up molding it and working it around to where it comes out sounding like, you know, something totally different, and it sounds good, and everybody's like, oh, this is this great new sound. And we're like, well, thanks. We like it, but it's really just what comes out of trial and error.
Well, the Blue Ridge Mountains with the fall of the night, it sure feels good when you cross that line. I tip my cup, holler at the moon, I said a great white north, honey, here's to your sleep tight. And I've gone crazy on this road, all this traveling alone, but the asphalt is burning tonight.
That trial and error method of moving songs from outside the bluegrass genre isn't too much in evidence on Nights. There's one tune co-written by 80s country pop singer Juice Newton and another from the contemporary folk genre by Nancy Griffith, but otherwise everything fits very comfortably under the bluegrass tag. Comfortable also describes how the Roos feel about their decision to leave their rock band days behind.
When we ended up stopping playing rock and roll, we just kind of let the rock and roll band go because we both decided as much as we loved the rock, we loved the music, but some of the venues that were available and just the whole persona, we weren't comfortable necessarily in our own skins always doing that. And bluegrass being a music that we already loved and being more, I always looked at it at that time and even now as a family music. You go to festivals and, you know, there's families and there's kids. It's a music that just transcends all age groups, and that's something that we both really loved about it.
One thing firmly in the bluegrass tradition on Nights, a couple of train songs. For Daniel Ruth, the train songs came before the train. He says this year he experienced his first long-distance train travel. While traveling, he thought of all the train songs he knew, but can't put his finger on what makes this mode of travel such an inspiration for songwriters.
We're lucky enough to still have a train come through our little town. And you know, you get a sleepless night or something, and I'm bad to go out back, you know, on the back deck or something like that. And I've been outside at night at 2 o'clock in the morning when the train comes through. And it's, you know, it's dead still. There's nothing going on. And you just hear this train whistle in the distance. And it's just, there's so many emotions that just roll up in that. And I have no way to explain it.
What if I'd held you in my arms?
If why trains make excellent songwriting fodder remains beyond Daniel's grasp, the inspiration from one of Knight's Daniel Ruth penned tunes is not. In fact, she's sitting right beside him.
It all sparked from, there's several Carolyn songs out there, and there's one, in fact, that Lonesome River Band did one time called Carolyn the Teenage Queen, and it was this tragic story of this, you know, she's like, why are all the Carolyn songs always bad? So I said, well, I'll write a good Carolyn song. But, yeah, the whole idea is to have a happy Carolyn song, not a sad or mean Carolyn song.
Send a letter, use the phone, let her know I'm coming home. It needs to be through the hills of Tennessee. The nights will be getting better, now she knows I can't forget her. My sweet Carolyn, back in my Carolina home.
Writing a happy Carolyn song is probably a bit redundant nowadays when you consider where New Blue is now after their near-tragic beginnings in 2003 following Carolyn's stroke. She describes herself and Daniel as all-or-nothing type personalities. Given where she started from that Thanksgiving weekend, she's gone from nothing to all and is grateful for every opportunity.
The amount of time that it took me to be able to get the use back of my side and be able to function again was remarkably short compared to what all predictions had been. And there's no other way to explain it besides just absolutely a miracle. And yes, I do feel very blessed every time I'm able to go on stage and perform or go in the studio and record and just be out there and be able to do what I love to the extent that I'm able to do it now. Yes, you got tired of having me around. So you took your love and pain every time. If you look for me when the sun goes down, you'll cry for me, but I won't be around.
Carolyn and Daniel Ruth are the co-founders of the Siler City Bluegrass Quartet New Blue. Their debut CD is Nights and is available on their own Red Squared label. I'm George Olson.
New Blue comes to Greenville this Sunday to close out the free Concert in the Park series hosted by the Greenville Parks and Recreation Department. The show starts at 7 p.m. at the Town Common on First Street and downtown Greenville this Sunday. For more information, go to publicradioeast.org and click on ENC Events.